Welcome to a new episode of Wellness and Women in Tech. I'm thrilled to be your host, Lee Olison, a dedicated coach for women in tech. In today's captivating conversation, I have the privilege of welcoming Alicia Dynamic as my special guest. Alicia is an expert in technology-focused educational programming and program development for community nonprofits and science museums. She currently serves as the executive director of The Generator, a prominent nonprofit community makerspace in Reno, Nevada. Alicia is also an artist and a mom, bringing a diverse range of experiences to our discussion. Together, we'll explore a range of important topics that shine a light on the experiences of women in the tech industry. We'll delve into the significance of embracing your identity as a woman in this ever-evolving field. Moreover, we'll confront the challenges of sexism and its impact on women's experiences within the tech industry. Additionally, we'll explore the realm of neurodivergence and uncover strategies for finding learning styles that resonate with you. Let's jump right in. So, Alicia, I am so excited to have you on. I've just been following your journey over 10 years as a maker, as an artist, as a woman in tech. You are incredibly inspiring for your eye for beauty through a community we've shared in the Burner community. And for those not familiar, that's with Burning Man and festivals that promote art, freedom, and self-expression and exploration. And we can get into that a lot more. But all that to say, thank you so much for joining today. I'm really happy you're here.
Thank you. To start off being emotional. Thank you. It's really nice.
So tell me about your journey as a woman in tech.
Okay. Well, I mean, I guess it really started. Well, I guess you could really say it started when I was a little kid. I was interested in things that were sort of technology adjacent. You know, I mean, I'm almost 40. So when I was a kid, it was like, you know, the early 90s. And so technology was different, of course, you know, than it is now in terms of what was consumer technology and how like accessible some of it was and et cetera. But one of the things I can remember being really interested in when I was young was anything that was remote control. And I think that there's an extent to which where that played into it. But interestingly, I really desperately wanted to build a remote control airplane when I was a kid. I used to like get those big catalogs that they made, the Tower Hobbies catalog, which is funny to think about now because it's so easy to look things up on the internet. I must have had to like call a phone number and have it delivered. I don't know, you know how you do that in like 1990. And just like I'd pore over the catalog and pick out all the little things. And it's only like I said, it's technology adjacent, but of course there's a lot of, you know, electronics and things that go into that. And I think that kind of like planted a seed for me a little bit, even though honestly, I never achieved that goal as a child. I was discouraged from a lot of that sort of thing on the basis of my gender. I was kind of told those aren't things that girls do. Although like fast forward to now, and I think that really planted a seed that led to one of the areas in which I've been interested and active in terms of technology, which is FPV drones. So now we have way better flying technological things. And I did get into that. And so I have a bunch of FPV drones and I built them from scratch and I can fly them. And that's actually like a skill and a pursuit that I'm really proud of because it was really hard. It takes a lot of effort to learn that. It's a skill that was hard won for me, I feel. But later in life, though, I would say what really led down the road of me working professionally in technological fields was going to Burning Man for the first time, which I went in 2010. The first time I went to Burning Man, I really didn't know what it was. I just knew there was like this art thing in the desert, and I'd seen some pictures, and I'm not really even sure why to this day I was so drawn to it, because it was very much out of my, I mean, I guess that's part of it. It was very much out of my life experience. It was like, I'd never been to a rave, or I don't know, I'd never been somewhere where people were doing drugs, or, you know, like things that are stereotypical about Burning Man. I didn't consider myself an artist, though I was always a maker. I always built things, but I had this construct in my head that like, I could only do things that were like, I was sort of given an instruction for. Like I sewed a lot. I did a lot of like fiber arts, like knitting and crocheting. And like when I was in high school, I like sewed my prom dresses and stuff like that. But I didn't think of myself as artistic, which of course now if I met younger me, I would have a lot to say to me about that? Yeah, so it was very much out of my comfort zone, even more so than I realized before I went. And I kind of just went on a whim, decided to go 10 days before the event. It blew my mind, and it really opened up my conceptualization, like my concept of what it meant to be an artist or a creative, and like what that could look like. Immediately, pretty much upon coming home, like my life just radically changed. I immediately got into doing a lot of weird immersive art stuff that there was sort of a zeitgeist to that sort of thing at the time, I think, in a lot of the country, actually. I watched a documentary a while back about Meow Wolf, and it was really interesting to watch that and see what the folks that ended up founding Meow Wolf were doing, like in the 2010, 2011, 2000, like that era, because it was like the same that we were doing on the East Coast with these weird parties. We'd spend weeks building all these immersive structures out of like cardboard and, you know, spray paint and bubble wrap.
And even, I don't know if you know Lauren Rasky, but I worked on a project with her where she found this material that filtered out UV light. It was this opalescent, iridescent material, and we created this tunnel where you could walk through and it would filter out the UV light. So in the daytime, it was like this cooling environment. That was such a cool thing about those events, is people would bring all sorts of materials and ideas to these immersive environments. It was what attracted me as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I just like, I'd never been around. I think like I had really bought into the construct of the artist in the ivory tower, and also being artsy as a type of person that you had to be. Like my sister was the artistic one in my family. And so she was the artistic one. It's kind of, you know, like, I don't know. It's these constructs that we have that I could, you know, get into a whole thing about my opinions about how I think that that's has a lot to do with the way capitalism and functions in our culture and the, you know, the way we sort of pigeonhole people. And
yeah,
I'm of the mind that like everyone, you know, has at least the makings of an artist, right? I think, you know, humans make art like birds sing. It's a thing that we do, and it doesn't have to be good or for money, or it's just a thing, you know, like you dance, you don't have to be a dancer. Anyway, with that said, like when I got involved in that, I started to build the foundation of a concept of self that I had been just lacking for pretty much my whole life up till that point. Found a community and found sort of like kindred spirits, I guess you would say, like people that were like me, I felt like. And I had for most of my life, really embarrassingly, I feel like now when I look back on it, like really tried hard to be like the people around me and really just tried to mirror the interests and the styles and of just the people who were popular, what have you, in the context of, you know, the small town in Pennsylvania where I grew up, and then the college that I went to. And I was very unsuccessful. I think it's worth mentioning in that pursuit, I was very socially unsuccessful in those times, which, you know, makes sense. it's not that appealing when people are very, you know, you're not really your own person. You're just trying to emulate what you see around you. So that's kind of what I was doing for so long. And within the Burning Man community and the greater like artist community around that, or just kind of weirdo community, I just finally started to forge my own path. I started to finally like find ways to even begin to break through figuring out who I was, or like what I was into, or like what mattered to me in a way that I just had never given myself space for. I was far too caught up in a sense of, I don't know, self-hatred and feelings of being not, you know, right, feeling broken in some way. So that kind of gave me a space to feel valuable in a way, or valued, or...
Is it okay if I interject?
Yeah, please.
I really relate. I mean, in university, I was doing a 3D animation digital media program, and I was trying so hard to match my peers who were all suited up, ready to go and get that job at Pixar. And I wanted to work at Pixar too. I thought that was really awesome. But when I found the burner community, suddenly art was way more expansive than just this cut and dry path of what you have to do. Even in my mind as an artist at the time, there was this narrow road that I had to follow. But when I found the burner community, it was wild. It was untamed. There was any option you could explore. And like you said, it was that weirdo community. I love that expression because I could just be weird and I could be different. I could raise eyebrows and that was encouraged. And it felt much more an authentic expression rather than what I was supposed to do. And it really was what I needed to do.
Yeah, same. I mean, the depth of the impact that that had on who I am and like the trajectory of my life is like really difficult to articulate. Like it was, I don't know where my life I would be at this point in my life if not for that. I certainly was not happy prior, you know, like as much as I would maybe categorize myself as a happy person now, which of course is a fraught thing, particularly living in the time, you know, in the context of the time in which we're alive, you know, here we are in the find out era. But I don't know. I had this, I feel like it's related, you know, related in a way. I had this experience recently of like being back visiting my family, and a family friend came over for dinner, and he's known me since I was very, very little. You know, he had kids the same ages as me and my sisters, and we all kind of grew up together. And so he really saw me through a lot of my life, like came to my first wedding. And he said, out of all of the kids, you know, there were six of us between this group of kids, like, you're the last one I would have thought would have ended up on the trajectory that you're on, like living this life that you're living. Like, I just never would have imagined this for you. It's so far from, you know, what I would have seen when you were young. And he's like, but also like, I didn't know even when you were a young adult, if I would ever see you happy. And I don't know, honestly, that was kind of a sad thing to say, right? But I don't know, it felt really good because it was extremely validating to feel seen in that I was really unhappy for a lot of my life and just didn't feel like I knew who I was or that I was like a shell of a person just trying to like figure out how to, you know, play the part of someone who would like fit in the culture in which I was immersed. And I sucked at it. I was not successful, you know.
How did art and tech can pull you into your true self? And tell me more about where that's led to what you're doing today.
Well, you know, I mean, so the art led to the tech because when I went to Burning Man, a big thing, of course, is lights. And if you've ever seen pictures of Burning Man at night, it's tons and tons of lights. And I will say that it was different. It was different in 2010, my first year. It's funny to think back. There's so much more lights now because, you know, the proliferation of LED technology has come down in price. It's become much more accessible and easier to work with. But when I first went in 2010, there were LEDs. People were using LEDs, you know, still there was still glow sticks back then because, you know, back in the 90s, it was like all glow sticks. So, you know, and LEDs are $9 a piece and stuff. But the lighting is such a big part of the experience. And I was drawn to that immediately, which of course, you know, that's just sort of a biological thing, right? We're so drawn to light as creatures, but I wanted to make things with lights. I wanted to create using that as a medium. And in order to work with lights in 2010, you really needed to learn to do electronics work and programming because there weren't all these off the shelf sort of solutions that there are now. I'm really grateful for the fact that I got into it when I did because it forced me to learn things that I think maybe I just probably wouldn't have, but I needed to immediately like learn how to solder. And I dove down into, you know, learning all about different types of conductive materials. And I can remember one of like the first things I can remember back in Philly in my art studio that I had which is kind of another part of the trajectory for me too, but was art studios, like shared studio space has been really important to me. But I can remember like sewing a project with like conductive thread and like twisting the legs of the little through-hole LEDs into little rings that I could wrap the thread around, because I came from a perspective originally of that kind of softer fabrication. You know, I was raised in a, you know, rather gender normative context, and a mode of expression that was introduced to me at an early age was sewing and different types of fiber arts. So that was a primary mode of creation for me. So I initially translated it in that way. But that pretty quickly led into, you know, wanting to be able to make the lights do things. And in order to make lights do things, you had to learn how to program some kind of controller. So that took me into learning about Arduino. And I pretty early on in that trajectory, in that like phase, I moved to Portland. I was really lucky early on in my time in Portland to be introduced to Paul Stoffergen, who's an electrical engineer, and he developed a microcontroller called the Teensy. So it's a pretty widely used microcontroller. And also he's just been very interfaced pretty heavily with like Arduino and the Arduino like ecosystem. And a lot of the work that he has done with Teensy actually really pushed a lot of the Arduino technology forward. Like he made a lot of advancements with his platform. And because it's all open source, there's a lot of synergy. There's a lot of knowledge sharing in that space. So he and I connected and he became a real mentor to me. I worked with him quite a bit during my time in Portland and would use Teensys. A lot of Teensy was kind of like where I cut my teeth on learning to program microcontrollers. And so I was doing a lot of like costuming work was a big thing for me.
Gorgeous costumes.
Thank you. So doing a lot of like wearable things, because like I said, my earliest like creating that I, you know, was sewing costumes and outfits. And even before I was sewing, just, you know, cutting up fabric and putting it together. So I'm very fortunate for my relationship with Paul. I really appreciate him a lot. He really was instrumental to that relationship was instrumental to me. And I even taught some workshops with him. Like we did a few workshops where we even traveled to, I went to San Francisco and did Hackaday, did an event called the Super Conference. And I helped teach a microcontroller based audio workshop there. I helped him create a tutorial video for the audio shield for that microcontroller. It's actually, if you ever go to the PJRC Teensy website, if you look up the audio shield, there's an hour and change long workshop and it's me and Paul working through it, which women in tech, man, I'll tell you what, you know what people really wanted to comment on that video was that I had painted my nails. Yeah, that's what I think about now, is people being like making comments about my nail polish in the comments and stuff like that, because I was in that video. But anyway, so yeah, I got to do a lot of cool things with him and with that platform. And because I was doing all this microcontroller work and I was really interested just as an enthusiast and a hobbyist in electronics, and I'm really interested in robotics, you know, as an enthusiast, I was working as a teacher. I guess I should say this, is that before I moved to Portland, when I was in Philadelphia, when I first went to Burning Man, I was living in Philadelphia and I was working as a public school teacher in Northeast Philadelphia. When I moved to the West Coast, I kept working as an educator, but I didn't go back into the traditional classroom. I started on my journey of becoming like an enrichment educator and, you know, in non-traditional settings. And I started out when I first got there just working at an after-school program. I just, you know, I needed a job and I got a job for a little nonprofit there doing after-school programming. And one of the things the instructors could do was start clubs for the kids. I started a robotics club and it was really just simple circuits. You know, we made like bristle bots and little like LED things. And it was, you know, simple circuits in the context of robotics. We talked a lot about different, you know, ways that robotics are used in the world and what have you. But That turned out to be such a pivotal thing. Like it was at the time kind of felt like a little thing that I did, you know, that I created this little club. And one of the things I did was I videoed a lot of it. And then I created like a 3-minute YouTube video for the parents, you know, so the parents could see, because there was like a parents' night. So they could see what the kids had been up to. And that was a temporary position because a lot of those positions, you know, they're just for the duration of the program and then resets. I was looking for a new job after that one ended, and I applied for another nonprofit with an after school program, and they brought me in for the interview, and I had sent this video of the robotics club as part of my application, and they brought me in for the interview, and they were like, you know, we watched your video and we have this grant to do this robotics program, you know, using the Lego NXT robotics system. And none of us like know anything about this, and we need someone to run this whole program and like build all this curriculum. It was a much more elaborate position than the one I applied for, but they were like, you know, would you be interested in that? Do you want to talk about that position? And I was, of course, like, absolutely. I was so stoked, you know? And of course, then I got that job and did that for, I worked with that organization doing robotics programs in middle schools in Oregon for about two years. I did two different grants, and that was at the same time that I at that point had also developed a small business making wearable stuff that incorporated electronics and lights that was, you know, primarily aimed at like the burner clientele. Cause one of the things about a lot of that, you know, and I still think this is a thing, but the thing about a lot of the stuff out there, particularly in those days, it's so disposable. A lot of the light up things that people are using. And I was interested in creating like a more, a well-made like artisan sort of like couture adjacent sort of like, you know, alternative product, if you will, for folks to wear, like to adorn themselves, that, you know, to light themselves up, because it's a safety issue too at night at Burning Man. Like the expectation, the cultural expectation is that you will wear lights on your body at night because it's super dark and people are riding bikes and scooters and there's art cars. And, you know, if you're not lit, it can be hazardous for you and people on these vehicles if they can't see you. So it's very, very commonplace there for people to own a lot of light up accessories. And, you know, there wasn't much in that space at that time, or honestly, still,
yeah.
I would say there's not a lot of that. So at the time I didn't know of anyone doing that. So I kind of like built this little brand where I was making mainly headpieces, but I did a lot of custom work and I did other things too. But the main thing that I did was like, I made these like winged headpieces with LEDs in them. And so I was running that, doing that at the same time that I was working in this educational space, because the education jobs tended to be termed because they were based on grants. So they'd be like a 6-month assignment at a time. And then I'd have a time in between. And also they'd be part-time. So I was able to really split my time between these pursuits. Yeah. So I did that for a while with that nonprofit in Portland, doing those robotics classes while making these wearables. And in that time, I ended up being invited to work on a large Burning Man project that was being built by a group of folks out of Reno that we had met, we being myself and my husband. We had met these folks 1 year at Burning Man and stayed in touch, and they were building this big project, and they asked us to build a component for it in Portland. And so we did that. And that was in 2014. They were building this project out of a space called the Generator. It was a new space at the time. It had just been founded in 2013. And a lot of these folks in the project were some of the original founders of that organization. It was a big maker space. So when we came down to Reno, we got to see the space, and I found it to be incredibly inspiring. As I sort of touched on earlier, like I had my first shared studio space with a few friends in Philly back in like 2010. Some of us got a workspace in this like derelict warehouse in Northeast Philly. And it was just like a really big deal for me at the time. Like my life felt like it moved really fast after I went to my first Burning Man. It was like a whirlwind. Suddenly I was like immersed in this world with this, like with these creative people working out of these like weird spaces. And it was just something I didn't even know existed. And all of a sudden I was in it. And I don't know, it felt so, I don't know, just like electric with like possibility at that time in my life. And some friends, some folks that became my friends had this space in this warehouse and we would hang out there and make weird art there. And like, you know, one of them made like props for LARPing, like big like weapons out of foam. And, you know, one had like a t-shirt business and was making all these weird kind of cyberpunky t-shirt and designs. And it was just kind of a really, and this space was just, and one was a painter and they had like this big space that was full of all this weird stuff and all this like weird half finished art, like a giant squid made out of styrofoam, you know, like it just like weird stuff. And it was so cool. And one day when we were there, I was like, man, this is really cool to having this space is, you know, and I think I might've asked like if it was expensive or something, and it was really cheap. I think it was like, they must've paid like $300 a month for it. And it was this huge yeah. space. And I know that, and I'm guessing that number because we were like, what? and so me and my best friend and our partners at the time, we were like, oh, let's look into this. And so we ended up renting I think it was 1200, maybe like 2000 square feet or something, like this space in this building. And we paid $200 a month for it,
which
was, you think like, it was awesome. We built, it was just such a neat time. Like we all had our workbench. We built these workbenches, you know, we built everything ourselves. We built out these big workbenches and we built this big loft that we put like mattresses and pillows in it. And like, we had like painted the walls pink and green and, you know, painted murals everywhere. And like, it was what a, you know, I think back on that and I go, wow, what a time in my life. I'm so lucky to have lived that. And that was my introduction into how instrumental it was to my creative process and like my creative life and my self-concept and the way that I managed my time and whatnot, to like have a space, to have like this space that was where I went to like be creative. That felt really important. And so from then on, I've pretty much always had a space like that, with brief lapses that during which times I'm always a bit adrift. It's become extremely vital to me. And so when I moved to Portland, I wasn't there super long before I founded a makerspace with a group of folks there. And this time it was a bigger one, somewhat bigger. I spent all my time there. There was a period of time when I lived there. I lived there in two different capacities. One time initially when my husband and I, we started a business building art, because he's a metal fabricator. He had been an engineer when we met, but he got laid off and we decided to try to make the art thing work. And that's been but it's been a challenging road to make that work financially. And in the earlier days of it, we found ourselves in a situation where we like couldn't afford to have an apartment and have this creative space. And so, you know, we chose the creative space. So we got a really shitty camper that we found on Craigslist for $1,300. And we lived in that for a year in the parking lot of the art studio. And then we lived in the art studio. We like rearranged things so we could live in a back room. And, you know, we went through the whole thing with that to make that work. And so the creative space was a big part of our lives. Also, like, you know, he got into a niche now of building really large scale metal art, like public art and installations and things, generally as a fabricator. It's not his art, but he's building it, you know, for someone else. And we needed more space, and we knew we didn't want to stay in Portland. So we decided to move to Reno in this time period. So now we're back to the Burning Man thing where we built the project in 2014, came down to Reno, found the generator, and we were like, starry-eyed, like, wow, you know, it was this 40,000 square foot warehouse, like full of weird art projects and people doing all kinds of crazy things. And we were just a community that has a space like this is a community that we want to be a part of. So we decided to move, but I'd been, you know, working in education and I knew we weren't going to move immediately. So I went to the Science Museum in Portland, OMSI, the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry, to volunteer because I have this interest in technology. I wanted to volunteer in the tech lab there. And when I went to, they do these like volunteer nights where all the each one of these labs, there's a chemistry lab and a biology lab and in the museum, and there are these learning labs, and each one is run by a senior educator, and they had them there, you know, you interview with them and figure out where you want to be. And I knew where I wanted, like people often come in not really knowing what they want to do. I knew what I wanted to do because I was so focused on technology as an educator at that point in my career. And I went to go interview for that, and they were like, you know, we're actually, the woman that I interviewed with was the education manager for the whole museum. And she said, you know, we don't actually have a senior educator in this lab right now. We're hiring for that. It was really funny because I had already told her I was moving. I'd been like, I'm looking for a temporary thing because I'm going to move. But when she told me that was open, I was like, dang, that's kind of a dream job for me. Like, I'm going to apply. And she was like, oh, well, I won't tell you not to. I said, I'm really not looking for a real job, but I guess I think I'll apply for it. And she was like, okay, you know, and of course, you know, fast forward, obviously I got the job or this wouldn't be that interesting of a story. So I ended up getting that job and I stayed in Portland for 2 years after that, which wasn't my original plan, but I wanted to be able to have that time working in that position. And it was amazing. It was a really, really wonderful experience. It was a great place to work. And I ran a learning makerspace that was technology focused. So we had 3D printers and, you know, a lot of different, we'd always have to bring in different things. And, you know, I got a lot of experience just kind of creatively thinking about ways to communicate technological subjects to the public. And it was cool because that's something that I'm very interested in is like demystifying these things. I guess I work within these constructs a lot as an educator and as sort of like, I guess at this point, like a community leader. Like, I think there's a lot of ways that we are encouraged to think in these very limiting ways about like who things are for, who's an artist, who's allowed to call themselves an artist. There's a lot to dig into there in terms of the psychology and like the way people think about that and how it goes back to like when they were kids and like what path you were on as a child. And I think there's a lot of similarities the technology occupies a very similar space in our consciousness, I think, collectively in our modern day society. It's also like for a lot of people, it's interesting to see that like those similarities in the way people approach technology and also art. I think there's both of these things, like we put them in these ivory towers and we categorize the people who we deem worthy or accomplished enough or appropriate for being the people that are artists or like the technologically minded people. I think there's a lot of parallels to be drawn between those constructs. And in both cases, they're quite limiting. Like in both cases, it's, in my opinion, very clearly just something that if you want to engage with it, you just start at the beginning and you learn it. You like anything, you know, and then if you want to be a painter, you start painting. If you want to be a coder, start coding, start like learning the basics of, you know, and it's for some reason we have this, so many people feel like there's this barrier for people in both of those pursuits where they they're like, oh, I'm not it. It's really, I actually don't know if I'd ever really thought about it so clearly before this moment of how similar, like I was working in, you know, as this technology educator where I was just talking to hundreds of people a week about tech concepts and the way people get physically, you can like see it in their, in the way that, they're so uncomfortable, like, I'm not that kind of person. I don't know about that kind of thing. Like they want to be like, ooh, that's not me. I can't, you know, I can't do that. Or I don't know about that. I'm not that kind of person. And people are the same way now that I work in the art world. People are the same way about that. I'm not an artist. I'm not, they're like, ooh, this isn't, it's, I'm really interested in like breaking that barrier. Like I really want to destroy that for people because it like, if you choose not to do it, sure, you know, like we all have our own interests, you know what I mean? But the idea that you maybe would have an interest in, and in both cases, I think there's so much of a reason for people to be encouraged to break through these barriers because like we are surrounded by technology, we are surrounded by art. Technology has become as easily as ubiquitous as art is. And art is ubiquitous. I think sometimes people don't think about it that way, but like you're constantly interacting with the work of artists and you're constantly interacting with technology. And like, it is hugely limiting to your sense of agency of as a human being in a society. If you feel like these are areas of existence or pursuits that like that aren't available to you, like that you're not allowed, that you aren't able to engage in by some like external metric, I hate that. I want people to feel like these are things they can do.
Yeah. And I hear you saying that what tends to hold people back or what can hold people back is this idea of what an artist is supposed to be like or what a person in tech is supposed to look like. And mm-hmm. I'm curious, as an educator and now the executive director of The Generator, what are your ways of demystifying tech, as you said, and breaking down these barriers of what people think they're supposed to look like so they can get out of their own way and just dive in?
For one thing, it's an easy answer, but I like to start with kids. For one, I think getting to people when they're young, I love being able to like work with younger folks because they're not fully sold yet in a lot of cases on this duality or this like construct. A lot of my work over the years has been focused on kids. And also a thing that I find to be rather useful or helpful is to present the concepts in a context that is more familiar for folks. Like I really like to combine the two. For one, I like to present technology in the context of art, even though that maybe sounds like way too much, then for whatever reason, that seems to work really well. I like doing really basic electronics concepts in a creative project, like kind of almost like a little surprise. You know, we're going to build these sculptures, but we're going to put a light in them. We're going to build a little circuit. And, you know, here's how you build a circuit. And now you know, here's how a battery works. Like a lot of some people just, you know, they don't know how a battery works. Being able to take something and break it down to such a small thing and then be like, you know, you can tell people, well, now you've done it. Now you've done this like building block of a thing, or, you know, doing educational exercises that are doing a coding concept, but it's not coding at all. You know, like there's this like very classic educational activity where you have kids walk you through making a peanut butter sandwich. I think stuff like that is brilliant. Like you're going to just walk me through making a peanut butter sandwich, but you have to assume I know literally nothing about how to make a peanut butter sandwich. And I'm just going to do exactly what you tell me to do. Just taking things and starting at the basics, and also just presenting people with examples of folks that are doing these things that are maybe not, don't look like what they expect. Sometimes, I mean, maybe this is a bit self-serving in a way to even say, but I think sometimes even just being myself and working in these fields that I've worked at and just speaking as someone who is in a position of knowledge about it has felt impactful. I think in a lot of cases, I know people for, you know, for whatever reason. You know, I personally don't look to a lot of people like someone who would know what I'm talking about in a lot of these areas, like microcontrollers, for example. You know, I've done a lot of microcontroller based education, and even just me being the person of expertise in the room, even just that can help.
Absolutely. I wanted to ask, you know, especially working with children, but maybe in other instances as well, how you have felt your representation as a woman in tech has impacted the people you're educating.
I certainly like to think that it has. I mean, even just little micro interactions, like when I ran that lab at the museum, I mean, it was a regular occurrence that people would come in and they'd have a question about something, you know, like a lot of times people come to the museum and they'd want to just like ask a question about, like, they're buying a computer, they're interested in 3D printing, they're interested in some sort of tech oriented pursuit. And they found themselves, you know, in the tech lab at the museum, and they went, oh, you know what, maybe this is a place where I can ask that question. It felt like a safe space for them to do that. And they would so often go straight for one of my volunteers, anyone who's a man in the room, right? And ask the question. And then they'd be like, well, I don't really know, but my boss could talk to you, and she's right there. And then they'd have to come talk to me about it, or I'd clarify a concept that, you know, someone's explaining, and they're kind of like, I got that a lot, was that, like, you know, you'd have it, and I try to be delicate, but, you know, you'd have like the dad coming in and being like explaining something, and they're just like really wrong. And I'm like, oh, you know, here's an educator. So I'm like, hey, you know, I just wanted to kind of clarify that this is actually, you know, about like some technology thing that we're exhibiting, you know, actually it's this, you know. I think even just those small interactions, just seeing a woman, and particularly like, not for nothing, but a woman that is like kind of maybe younger than people would think, or more fashionable. I really think it's like those types of things, I think, play so heavily into people's perception. Like, okay, maybe like women do this, but not women that like dress in this way, you know, or like I'm sure I don't have to explain to you, like the sort of like, okay, we, this less represented demographic of person, okay, some of them do it, but like only if they're also fit into these preconceived ideas of what they should look like or how they should act. And
it's really so odd how cut and dry it seems somewhere, I don't know where, but this image exists of what you're allowed to look like.
Someone that I do admire quite a bit, and I'm actually count as a friend, is Anouk Whipwrecht, if you know who that is. She's a tech artist, a wearable tech artist, and she's Dutch. She's from the Netherlands, but she is very accomplished in that field. And she just announced, I think I saw on her Instagram yesterday, that she's partnering with some like immersive dining experience in New York City, like creating costuming for it. But she's had residencies with like Intel and Audi and lots of like big deal, like huge corporations. Like, I was just chatting with her recently, and she was like, because I was in Miami and she used to live in Miami, and I thought maybe she was still there. And she said, oh no, I'm actually back in New York, but I'm not even there. I'm on my way to Malta because I have a thing I'm doing there. Like, she's very accomplished, but whenever you see her, she just looks like a pixie. She dresses like, she's so hyper feminine in her presentation, and she's always wearing like just ethereal kind of out, you know, wears a lot of like tulle and pale purple and iridescent white. And she just like, she has a very strong aesthetic and look. And I appreciate that so much, because I really think just like the representation of just being like a woman who's going to come out there and look beautiful and feminine and look like, and be the expert in the room, I think is, incredibly valuable that it's not, we're not only allowed at the table when we're like emulating the men around us to the highest level that we can.
Absolutely. I'm having a flashback to when I worked in a very corporate environment and I asked, how do you feel about me dyeing my hair blue? The answer was no. So the day I quit that job, I dyed my hair blue. And I remember as a freelancer going to similar corporate environments, walking through and just sticking out. It felt funny to me. I almost got a laugh out of it because I was like, I'm being true to myself and that feels good.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of it, I think, too, is just that, like, it's scary to, like, take up space or feel like you're drawing attention to yourself, I think, as a woman in a tech space, because there's already so much. I feel like it's just palpable in so many cases, the, like, way that the pressure feels on you to, like, represent the entire gender with, like, what you bring to the table or like what your skill set is. And you're all, like, one of the things I found throughout this like journey, you know, has been how to articulate it. I feel like you can't even like really explain it sometimes to people that haven't experienced it, because I've been so invalidated and so I think gaslit about this, that like you get treated so differently. Like people come to you, people just want to like, the, you know, men, they want to like just pick apart whatever you do. And like, man, it's like, it's even hard to figure out how to talk about this already, right? Like I, you know, anytime I have like a project that incorporates some kind of technology, like invariably I get like men that clearly don't understand it, like understand less about it, like it's obvious just from the way they talk about it that they don't understand much about it, like, but they still think that they know more than I do about it, like even though it's my project, and they like, just from the way, you know, just from like the way they're talking about it, you're like, oh, you don't, this is like a new thing to them or whatever, but they still will want to like tell you what you could have done different, or tell you like how to, well, did you do that? They want to like ask you all these questions about, like, it's like you're always being like quizzed and challenged, right? I think. And like, I, you know, it's almost like I hesitate. Well, I don't, obviously I didn't hesitate to talk about this, but there's an extent to which where in some spaces I do, because it's like, it's so frustrating to be so invalidated, because then they're so quick to be like, we all do that to each other too. It's like men are just, we just do. And I'm like, no, you don't. Like, you really don't do it to each other like you do. Like, you are really so, in some cases I felt like it's like this bothered, like they want to come to you and pick you or where I, man. So when you bring it, when there's an extra, like when you feel like just the way you present yourself in day to day can bring extra attention, like there's, you feel like a pressure to sort of like dull yourself down a little bit, like try to draw less attention to yourself because you're already like going to get just from like being in that space. I've experienced this a lot, you know, in the world of like microcontroller electronics based projects and things like that, which I've done a lot of, but also like the drones that I brought up earlier, like the FPV drone world, for those who aren't familiar with that, when it's first person view is FPV, and it's like quadcopter drones that you fly wearing goggles. There's a camera on the vehicle, on the aerial vehicle, and you are wearing goggles while you're flying it, and the goggles are like seeing through the camera. It's like a real-time feed. And so like on one hand, it's super cool and exciting to fly them because it's like, you're in it. It's like being, it's very exciting. It's also very challenging because it's, you know, it's disorienting. You're like, it takes a lot of focus. And when you're flying a freestyle drone, like the kinds that I was flying, which are the same ones that are in the races, if you've ever seen like drone races, you're completely controlling it. So it's very fine tuned movements. It's a very challenging hand-eye coordination thing. And it takes a lot of, practice and a lot of broken equipment to get to where you can be competent in it. And it is the most male dominated thing I've ever engaged in. I have almost never been in a space where there was even another woman who did it at all. Mm-hmm. Like I very rarely even like met in real life another woman who like knew how to fly an FPV drone. And, you know, like, again, like there's no, there's no reason for that besides perception and hostility, I would say. But
I know that, that was like a big hobby for a friend of mine, a guy, and he actually left because of the language and the attitude this group of men had about women. Just made him uncomfortable. He left.
Yeah, it sucks. And I actually was pretty, there was like a micro drone racing like community here in Reno that I kind of like got into and then like left because the, honestly, like the politics and the attitudes of the people who engage in it were just not tolerable for me. But, you know, I would go to these things and I would be the only woman who, there'd be women there, like the guy's girlfriends, but they were there to just hang out or to do, like, sometimes they even would be so involved as they'd like moderate the races and things, but they would be like, oh, I could never fly. Cause they'd come to me and be like, wow, it's amazing that you can do, like, I could never. And I'm just like, why do you think your jabroni ass, like mediocre boyfriend can do this and you can't? Like you, what does he have that you don't, you know, like literally. And in that community, like if I would post anything in like a forum, it would be like, that had a picture of me. It would be like, post some of your video, post flying videos, post both, because they'd be like, you couldn't possibly be able to do this. It was always the subtext. And I'm like, there's no men posting like a picture of the drone they just built. And then like a barrage of comments of like, prove to us that you can actually fly this. This is a hobby that caught, this is like this hobby. Like it's a hobby where like it costs a lot of money and time. Like I have thousands of dollars that I've spent on like just a very, not very impressive suite of equipment. And you think I'm faking it? Like, what? So it's very strange.
What is your secret? I mean, you have pursued your dreams, you've pursued your interests, and you've risen to executive director. I mean, you are a leader in your field now. You had to overcome a lot of this kind of attitude. And what's your secret? What would you say to anyone who's dealing with this type of pressure?
You know, I actually had this realization kind of last night, interestingly enough, because I was watching a nature documentary, because it's like the kind of thing I like to watch. And I watch everything with subtitles now, which isn't something I used to do. It's something I switched over to like about a year ago. I started watching everything with subtitles. Also, backstory to this, backstory is I've always been, I would say, pretty clearly neurodivergent. I had a really hard time as a kid in school and mainly socially. I have this whole like trajectory with that of like psychological evaluation and my parents not really wanting to pursue any type of diagnosis for me and sending me to private school to avoid, frankly, you know, I think they had at least mostly, you know, good intentions with that, but realistically did preclude me from getting any type of like diagnosis and then of course services or accommodations, and which it was, you know, which they believed I didn't need because I was always highly intelligent, you know, if I can say that without being sounding self-aggrandizing, but just in terms of like on paper or whatever. And, but I still like, I struggled, even though I clearly had like a, you know, a high aptitude and high scores on things like my standardized tests and IQ and things like that. But I did struggle quite a bit throughout my entire educational career. And I continue to struggle in certain ways. And a few years ago, I, through a conversation actually with my mom, I brought the concept of autism, and another person came up, and my mom said, you know, and I remember this very distinctly. She was like, you know, I always thought maybe that's what was wrong with you, because the construct within my family had always been like, obviously something's wrong with Alicia. We don't know what, but like clearly. Which is a weird way to kind of like, you know, there's a lot to unpack in that, right? For you know, for my therapist or for a different day. But I had never considered the idea that I'd always felt that I was certainly diagnosably neurodivergent in some way, but I didn't know beyond that. And my mom saying that, I'd never considered the idea that it was autism spectrum. And I went down a whole rabbit hole for about 2 years, honestly, of reading books and taking self-assessments, and, you know, which always put me very high into the like, yeah, you're probably autistic range, and reading books written about the experience of being a autistic woman, as this is now something that we're finding, you know, this is now becoming somewhat of a common story, you know, because like so many things, our diagnostic criteria and our just cultural conceptualization of like what an autistic individual looks like is just very different from the reality of what like a lot of women who are able to function to a high degree, but, you know, at least superficially, like what their experience is and what the manifestation is of this particular disability. So I would go down a rabbit hole and like read another book and do more and be like, this has got to be what the deal is. But then I'd get really discouraged at what my perceived inability to get a clear answer, as because it's quite difficult to pursue. It can be quite difficult to pursue a diagnosis as an adult who's like living your life, who, you know, holds down a job. It's kind of like there's sort of almost like a institutional perception of like, well, why do you even need to know this? Like, who cares? Clearly you're fine. Even if, you know, in a lot of ways you're not fine. Like there are a lot of ways in which I've been very not fine throughout my life because of the ways that I struggle with things that feel like I think a construct that I now see in myself is that I tend to find things that a lot of people think are really difficult to be easy, or maybe not easy, but like the pursuit of them is natural. But like things that come easily to people, I find really difficult. Like in a lot of ways, that's flipped in very notable ways for me. So I finally did pursue a diagnosis, and I was, as at that point, unsurprisingly diagnosed with autism and ADHD last year. And it's given me a new lens through which to look at a lot of the ways that the trajectory of my life and the ways that I've come to interact with the world. And one of the realizations that I had that actually just popped into my head last night, watching this freaking nature documentary about wolves with subtitles, because I was thinking about how I so much more enjoy watching TV and movies now that I just watch them always with subtitles. It's become clear to me how I don't process spoken language very well. I struggle with that a lot. I have a lot of, I think I have a lot of auditory processing differences from the average person. I always found things difficult to follow. And, you know, I was always like the person being like, wait, what's going on? You're like, what's happening? What? And once I started watching the subtitles, a simple accommodation, it turns out, suddenly it really shifted that. And I suddenly had this like big realization last night that I was like, you know, a thing that I have a ton of guilt about is that when I was in college, I skipped class a lot. I went to a large state school and I had a lot of big lectures. And I had a lot of lectures where they didn't know if you were there or not. You know, you were expected to go, but you know, and if I felt that I could get away with skipping a class, I did. I mean, I did fine in college. I graduated with like a double major and a minor and a certificate, and I finished in 4 years. And I, you know, but I still, because I didn't have like a really super high GPA. And so I feel like a chronic underachiever. It's hard for me to, I'm one of these personalities that I have trouble feeling good about my accomplishments. I really only see the ways that I could have done better. And I feel very guilty for many years, feeling like I squandered this very privileged opportunity of being able to go to college at 18 and have help paying for it from my parents and things like that. And that I would skip class. I've since, especially as an educator, felt deeply shameful about that. Wow, I was such a, you know, I have some very bad feelings relative to that. And I sort of had this realization last night that I was like, I really found it so unpleasant to be in class. And I think that it was in very large part around that I just couldn't follow what was happening in a lecture. And I just couldn't follow the teacher. I didn't have a context for understanding my inability to receive that information in that manner. And the construct of like a classroom where I am like listening to someone talk has always felt kind of painful to me. Mm-hmm. And I've sort of had this realization that in my like more empathetic, because I, you know, I'm on this journey of like self-empathy, right? Like a lot of us, that I found that really difficult. I think a lot of my difficulty with it was just not really understanding what the problem was and feeling bad about myself, it like increasing my relentless feelings of inadequacy. And I think that even if I had just had a subtitle, if there could have had like a subtitle, you know, to it, it maybe really, really would have changed my experience. But with that said, because I always felt in college, like I can go to the lecture or I cannot, I'm still going to just go home and figure it out. I'm still just going to go home and look at the book or whatever, you know, the learning material. I'm going to just go over it on my own time alone. And I'm going to teach myself. That's how I'm going to learn it. Like, that's how I learn everything. I do it myself. I can't listen to like the traditional learning environment didn't work for me. And so that was just what I did. I developed this very strong autodidact way of moving through the world. Because of that, I think that became a sort of superpower then for me, is I'm very confident in my ability to learn how to do something on my own. It feels very simple to me that other people can do this thing. I could do it too. I just need to like find the correct resource to learn how to do it. And then I'll keep doing it until I learn how to do it. And it's funny because I'm just such an avid doer. I am obsessed with learning new skills. And as such, I have learned, you know, so many skills over the years. It's very much like making things is like a very strong interest for me. And I've learned how to do just tons of different things. I mean, I talked about the drones, but like, you know, I taught myself how to silversmith during the pandemic, and I can weld, and I can program electronics, and I can sew, and I can knit, and I can crochet, and I have a really long list of things that I've learned how to do over the years. And a lot of times people will be like, oh, I wish that I could do those things. Like, which has always been a really puzzling thing for me. I'm always like, well, you could, you just need to do it. And people, I'm also really not afraid to be bad at something. I don't mind that. I find it exciting to be doing something that I'm bad at, because I'm like, oh, I'm going to get to learn how to do it. And I love that learning curve. I love being in that space of like learning something new. And I accept on a fundamental level that the requirement for that is that you're going to have to suck at it. I think because of particularly, I think this is magnified by social media appearances culture, that we don't see that. We really see people being good at things. And we're like, you know, a lot of people are like, I wish I could be good at things. Like you're good at things. And I'm like, really what I'm good at is being bad at things. Like that's where the, you know, the power is in learning things. And, you know, like even just right now I'm working on it. I'm knitting a hat for a family member, and I just pulled out a few hours of work for the fourth time on this one project. I could be done with it for the amount of time I've put into it, but I keep just fucking it up. And so I just have to like pull it all out and start over. And I just pulled out hours worth of work for the fourth time. And I just was thinking about that while I was doing that. I thought, you know, when I finish this hat, if I show it to anyone, if I like make an Instagram post about it or something, even if no one says it to me, I can surmise from just the patterns of the experiences I've had throughout my life that someone somewhere is going to look at that and think, oh, I wish I could do that. I wish I was good at things like that. And I'd be like, bud, I have been knitting for 15 years, 20 years, something like that. I don't remember. I think I was like 20 when I taught myself to knit. And I relentlessly have been fucking this project up, but I just start over. Like, I just know I can do it. I don't know. I think it just has to do with this perspective that I have on the world, but the challenges that I've had throughout my life because of my like neurodivergence, like profile or what have you, I think have actually like weirdly and uniquely equipped me to be successful in these areas, because it isn't that it's easy. It's actually that it's hard.
There's such a wealth of wisdom there. And thank you for sharing your perspective, because I have seen in the world that there is a very different definition of neurodivergence and how it's represented in men and women. There's this perspective of the way, for example, autism or ADHD represents in men or boys versus women or girls. And due to that, a lot of women aren't diagnosed when they're children and they don't receive the assistance they could have had in learning. And I think it's really important to talk about that. I think it's really important for people to know that if they're feeling like there is a better way to be learning something, or there is a way of learning that they're experiencing that's not resonating with them, to be curious about that and to pursue alternatives. If something isn't coming to you, but you're interested in pursuing a craft or whatever it is, then try it differently than other people are doing it, or seek support and, you know, talk to a psychologist or a psychiatrist or a doctor to find out ways of getting assistance with that. I think as an educator, you had a deeper understanding of different avenues of learning. And the psychology of learning is really fascinating to me, because there are so many different ways we can learn. And I don't think that always comes across in public or private education. I think it's beautiful that you have persevered and it's strengthened your ability to find ways of doing, but also being okay with messing up and trying again. It's something that's really inspired me about you over the years, as I see you pick up coding or soldering or silversmithing or costume making. And I just love that, because I think there's so much out in the world to explore, and there's no reason for any of us to feel like we can't explore it. So it's always inspired me that you have continued to explore and create.
Yeah, thank you.
And I hope in a way that what I said accurately kind of reflects what you've been talking about.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, I would agree. And I would add too, in terms of like resources, and if anyone listening to this is on like their own journey of trying to seek an understanding of their own like neurological differences, or if any of that resonates, particularly the autistic community, like self-diagnosis, particularly as an adult, particularly as a woman, particularly as someone who like doesn't have huge impediments in their daily, day-to-day life. A lot of the psychology, like just the way that things are, way that it functions in our society, like it's really focused around a deviation from an ability to assimilate or whatever, you know. It's not necessarily focused around like self-understanding and well-being the way like maybe it could be. Because of those constructs, it can be really difficult to pursue like a formal diagnosis or something like that. But self-diagnosis is extremely accepted within that community because of the understanding of that. And also just, it's such a common thing for the same personality type that, and you know, neurological profile that falls into that, you know, essentially cluster of symptoms that is any like psychological diagnosis that, you know, makes up an autism spectrum sort of designation. Self-diagnosis is extremely accepted. And also like, there's a lot of resources and community, like there's a lot of community, there's a lot of forums and communities that you can engage in. And I would say, like, you shouldn't be afraid to engage in those communities and look for support or suggestions or things like that, even if you aren't diagnosed. Outside of like the medical / psychological psychology community, there's a lot you can access and learn from if that is not accessible for you. I guess that's like something that I wanted to put across because it isn't accessible for a lot of people. I was fortunate to be able to afford just like paying out of pocket and like finding a doctor that was, you know, someone that I could have that assessment. But for a lot of people, that's just not, I certainly let it hold me back for a long time in sort of starting down the road of integrating this understanding of my own neurology or whatever you would say. And it has been, it's still hugely a work in progress for me, but it's been a really big, I have experienced a lot of improvements already in that process. And I expect more as time goes on and I keep putting in work with it, but just having that self understand, a deeper understanding and like having a frame of reference and a context for a lot of the things that I struggle with, because it's easy to chalk them up to like a personal failing or like a character issue. Cause that was the way that I was very encouraged, like influenced to understand my own struggles for a lot of my life, was that they were character failings that I had, that I just, you know, if I were a better person, if I worked harder, if I cared more, was a big one. You know, if I cared, it was like a lot, you know, that was a real mind for me throughout a lot of my life, to feel like, to be told that these failings or perceived failings were because I didn't care enough and I didn't try hard enough and things like that. And when I cared a lot and felt like I was trying really hard, I just didn't look the way that I guess thought it should look, or the people around me thought it should look. So yeah, I don't know. I think there's a lot to be gained in terms of like in the world of like self-compassion and better lenses through which to understand your own manner of navigating the world through this. Like, I have no like embarrassment or anything about that diagnosis. I feel less broken or less dysfunctional or wrong for having it and for accepting that. It only has made me stronger and also allowed me to see things as accommodations that I need. And it's weird. That's very empowering, actually, like the subtitles thing. I guess I can get by without watching things without subtitles, but it's night and day difference in how I am able to absorb something. And in my office, I keep my lights really low, just things like that, like little things in my life, these little accommodations that I make for myself now make a really big difference. I think it's going to be like probably the rest of my life chipping away at all this and figuring it out, but it feels really good to be on that path. So I would encourage other people, if it feels relevant, to be emboldened to like take those matters into your own hands, and also not really worry so much too about what other people have to say about it, because that's a tough one, but that's a whole people.
Yeah.
Well, it's like too, you know, you say, oh, I'm autistic. People are like, don't know what to do with that. They're like, I don't know. It's weird. It's weird.
You brought so much to the table today, and throughout it all, I heard this thread of self-acceptance from your childhood and growing up and finding yourself and finding who you really are versus who you think, who others tell you someone is supposed to look like, and weaving that into your journey as a maker, as an artist, as a woman in tech, and finding your own way, finding the spaces and places that felt good to you, and discovering more along that path through beauty, through art, and this path of self-exploration going outward, but also inward.
I hope it's not too all over the place.
It's really not. It's really not. I think it's really important to highlight what can come from a life of finding your own way and finding what feels good to you, and taking the opportunities when they come, listening to your heart, listening to what comes up as you learn, and always being curious about how that can be tailored more to your own experience, to your own mind, knowing that whatever that looks like, it's true to you, and it doesn't have to look a certain way for anyone else.
Yeah.
So it was a really beautiful interview, truly. Yeah.
Thanks for having me. It's interesting to have a floor to like talk about this kind of thing. You know, I do a lot of thinking, but when you actually have to articulate it, I think there's a lot of like healing in that. Thank you for this. It was really great.
Thank you for joining me on this thought-provoking episode of Wellness and Women in Tech. I hope that my conversation with Alicia has provided you with valuable insights into the experiences of women in the tech industry. As a coach for women in tech, I'm passionate about supporting and empowering individuals like you to navigate the challenges of this ever-evolving field. If you're seeking guidance, resources, or personalized coaching to enhance your career journey, I invite you to visit my website at leolisoncoaching.com. You can also connect with me on Instagram and LinkedIn. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider leaving a review and sharing it with your friends and colleagues. Your support helps me reach more women in tech and create a thriving community. Thank you again for tuning in, and I look forward to continuing this empowering journey with you on the next episode of Wellness and Women in Tech. Until then, keep embracing your identity, conquering challenges, and taking care of yourself in the world of tech.